Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Cringe.
That was Candace, not Elena, just so you know.
It was you. That's the great thing about podcasting. Right. I could just blame it on you. How you doing, Lena?
I'm good.
Good. How's your back?
It's numb right now.
How's your old lady
back?
Because
I've been sitting on it forever.
Well, I slept wrong, so I've got like a crick in my neck, and I can't move my neck
past here.
So all day I've been like, don't do that, and I just can't like have to turn my entire body around.
Have you been lifting heavy boxes?
No, I think it's the way I slept.
Oh.
I slept really wonky.
Yeah.
It's one of those cricks.
Have you been to the chiropractor?
I need to go. In fact, I said today that I was going to make an appointment, but the problem is they're closed on Wednesdays. Why would you be closed on Wednesdays?
Yeah, that doesn't fit my schedule. Thank you very much.
It's the day I get all my stuff done. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, and they're also closed on the weekends. So like, how are you going to be open 4 days a week?
Agreed. Yeah.
Doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So that's very inconvenient for me. That's why I'm all rickety.
Do it before it gets worse.
Well, last week we talked about your case, which was horrific.
Yes.
And the most maddening part was that, you know, we were dealing with a repeat offender, right?
Mm-hmm.
And many crimes could have been prevented. Well, I'm sorry to say that we're heading back down that road today. Mm-hmm. Our story takes place in Grand Ledge, Michigan. It's a small town located about 15 minutes west of Lansing, Michigan. It's got a small town feel. Being that it's only 4 square miles, but it's visited for its towering sandstone rock features, which I think you might really like, Lena.
Oh, okay.
So September 22nd, 2011, couple Ruby and Eugene Post were retired living in Grand Ledge and had plans to meet with their daughter, Terry Green, to meet for lunch. Ruby and Eugene arrived at the restaurant. They grabbed a table, engaged in a little bit of chit-chat, and pretty soon they realized what the time was. Terry hadn't arrived, and she was always on time, especially when it came to family. So Ruby tried calling her daughter, but it just rang and rang and went to voicemail. And just as soon as Eugene realized Terry didn't answer the phone, he picked up his phone and called Mike, Terry's husband.
Yeah.
Now, almost immediately, they got an answer, and it was strange, because to them, he answered the phone like, hey, and Eugene was a little taken aback by that, but he asked for trying to get a hold of Terry, do you know where she is? And Mike said, she left to go shopping.
Okay.
Well, they knew that wasn't the case, because they had plans with her, and she wasn't the type to just flake and go do something else when she had plans. So they decided to go over to Terry's and check to see if she was fine, if she was there, or hopefully Mike was there and he could tell them a little more information about when Terry left, where specifically she said she was going, etc. Ruby stayed in the car while Eugene approached the door to enter the home, but it was locked. This was another red flag to him because that door was always unlocked during the day, at least. It was one of those houses, you know, that you just walked in, kind of like Grammy and Granddad's house. When we were growing up, you don't knock, you just walk in. So, unable to get inside, Eugene walked around the front door, which was not the most readily used door, but that one was unlocked. When he walked in the house, it was really quiet. He called out for Mike, and then he called out for Terry because her car was actually in the driveway, so he assumed maybe she was home. And he got no answer. Now, he slowly scanned the front room, then the dining room, then the living room, and that's when he found Mike, his son-in-law, laying on the floor in a pool of blood.
Mike was laying?
Yes, Mike was laying on the floor. And he had touched his face.
Okay.
And he was cold, so he knew. So he ran to the car to tell his wife what he had just found and told her, call 911. Now, the dispatcher asked her all these usual questions that they do. You know, what's your emergency, etc. She was answering these questions. But she was also kind of talking to her husband because they were still looking for Terry at this point.
Yeah.
Now, there was a pond just down the hill near Mike and Terry's home, which they could see from the driveway. Mm-hmm. And Eugene must have seen something down there because he started down the hill towards the small body of water. And you can hear in the 911 call the moment Eugene calls out to his wife that somebody was in the water.
Oh, Lord.
Because she's talking to the dispatcher and she's going, no, we can't find... Oh, hang on a second. What is it, honey? Oh, no. Gosh. There's somebody in the water. So it's all unfolding, like, as she's on the phone with the dispatcher. And you can hear the terror in her voice. She's like, dear God, please don't let that be Terry. But it was her daughter. Terry's body was mostly submerged in the water with her head resting on the shore. Now, when Eaton County detectives arrived that afternoon, they found Mike dead at the scene, which they did expect to find, but what they didn't expect to see is how he was found. Now, Mike's pants were pulled down. Something you don't see often in homicides involving men, but that's not actually the worst part.
Oh my Lord.
There were some documents stuffed up his rectum.
What?
Yes. And they knew then someone was angry, like angry with Mike. Why else would someone degrade him like that?
Well, yeah.
Now, once they got over the shock of that, they scanned his body for other trauma and found that he had bullet wounds in his hand.
Oh.
One in the back of his head and two in his back. There was blood spatter low on the ground. Low to the ground on the wall. So they opined that he had been kneeling,
right,
and this may have been an execution-style murder. So they also found a piece of paper kind of laid on the top of Mike's body. It was more of a receipt or ledger, if you will, for a vehicle that Terry had sold someone named Ronald King. There were also bullet holes in other places of the home as well, indicating he was likely being shot at for some time before he eventually was killed and came to rest there in the living room. There was a bullet hole in the glass door.
Okay.
One went through a cabinet in the kitchen, and they found one through a TV as well. Now, they recovered a couple of those bullets, which turned out to be .38 caliber.
Okay.
As another set of investigators moved through the house to kind of scope out the rest of the scene, they found Terry's purse on a dresser, but her wallet was gone and her cell phone was gone. Matter of fact, Mike's cell phone was also nowhere to be found. The place was not exactly ransacked, but they couldn't eliminate robbery as a possible motive due to the wallet and the cell phones being missing. And there were guns missing, actually, too. Next, they went out to the pond to assess Terry's body. They found that she had been shot between the eyes and in the back of the head. She was fully clothed, and it was apparent that she was just kind of left there after being shot. It almost seemed that Mike was the target, and Terry might have just been witness to it, you know? Wrong place, wrong time. But none of Mike and Terry's friends or family could even imagine who would have it out for them.
Hmm.
Either one of them. They were loved by their small community, which hadn't seen a murder in over a decade.
Hmm.
That's crazy to me. Now, all this time, still at the house were Terry's parents. They recounted to detectives that they spoke with Mike just moments before they arrived. At least they believed they were talking to Mike, but now they were questioning that. That weird way that he answered the phone with, "Hey," and, you know, "Come to think of it," Eugene said, "now I don't think that even sounded like Mike."
Yeah, that's what I would assume.
A canvas of the area turned up one very important clue. The window of time when the murder might have taken place.
Yeah.
When a neighbor was asked, "Did you hear any gunshots recently?" she said, "Yeah, but there's a gun range near here."
Oh.
"But I did hear a couple shots coming from that direction," and she pointed towards the Green residence. And she thought those shots happened around 1:30 or 2 that afternoon.
Wow.
She didn't know of anyone who would hurt the Greens either. She said they were the nicest people. They always left their door open. So if anyone wanted to come by, grab a beer, they were welcome to do that. They just needed to walk in. In addition to the neighbors, they also wanted to talk to this Ronald King guy. You know, the name that was on the receipt that was so crudely displayed on Mike's body, especially since they learned that he had a criminal record.
Oh, wow.
He was arrested for assault a few years prior, but the charges were dropped.
Oh.
Now, when they pulled up to Ronald's house, they saw a car outside. And after speaking with Ronald, it turns out that was the car that he bought from Terry. He said he had no problems with the car or the Greens. He said they were friends and, you know, he was really enjoying his new ride. And he seemed really shocked to hear the news of the double homicide at the Greens residence. When pressed about where he was and what he was doing the day and the time of the murders, he explained that he was at work all day. And, you know, of course, this can easily be verified. So they checked with his employer, which was a heating and cooling place. So he was actually out on the road on service appointments all day. And when they scrutinized the schedule, they thought he might have an opportunity to have gone by Mike and Terry's home that afternoon. They thought maybe he had fallen behind on the car payments because he was still making payments to them. He didn't just buy it outright. So what if he killed them to settle the score? Take care of the problem. But Ronald King was very cooperative with the detectives, and he gladly took a polygraph and passed. So was this vehicle receipt placed on Mike's body to throw the police off? So besides the sale of the vehicle, they tried to get to know what was going on in Terry and Mike's life. Who were they? What's their past? What's their present? Terry and Mike actually met while working for the Michigan State Police. And Mike had spent his career as an undercover narcotics detective and retired about the time he and Terry began dating. The source material is unclear as to if he was already retired or retired after they got together. But Terry had a grown son, Brian, and Mike had an adult daughter and adult son. And everyone just kind of felt like they were the perfect match for each other. His daughter said that even though her dad had a lengthy career undercover in law enforcement, he didn't have any bad blood with anyone that she could think of. So that probably wasn't a factor. And she said something that I always think about when I hear of a cop or someone in the military being murdered. Their families worry about their safety when they're on the job, but they never dream that they would be murdered in the safety of their own home. So as they got going with talking to those involved with Terry and Mike, some of their friends might have had names to give detectives that their family may have not necessarily known about. Something they learned very early on was that Mike and his son, Sean, had been estranged for years. The reason is unclear, and actually, when police tracked him down, he didn't want his family knowing his contact information or where he was. Okay. Sean had been in California on business, so they kind of turned their attention elsewhere after verifying his story with his employer, and that was that. Another thing they learned very early on in the investigation was that Mike had a female companion named Tanya Jones. No. Now, the details are a little fuzzy here. I'm not sure if there was some infidelity, but Mike and Tanya were romantically involved for years, but it was very low-key. But even after their relationship ended, they remained in contact with each other. When police went to speak with Tanya, her husband came out of the house. They were kind of sitting on the porch, her and the detectives, and her husband kind of pokes his head out. And he was very perturbed that they were talking to her about Mike. So he didn't know that her and Mike were actually still in touch. And he quite frankly didn't want to even talk to police about Mike. He shut down. He wouldn't provide where he was at the time of the murders. He wasn't willing to take a polygraph. And even though he wasn't exactly a person of interest initially, he was now. He didn't do himself any favors there. It's now been 3 days since the murders, and police were feeling the pressure. Not just from family and the community, but from themselves. They took it personally that there were two former officers murdered, and they weren't going to get any sleep until this person was caught.
Right.
It seemed like all other obvious leads weren't amounting to anything, and they were very frustrated. That is, until they spoke with Marcia Poxon, a friend of the Greens. Her and her husband had been over at Mike and Terry's the night of the murders, and when they got there, they were dumbfounded to see this other person there, a guy named Ryan Waters. Ryan and Mike had been very close in the past, even roommates at one point. But they had had a falling out years before and hadn't spoken. Terry told Marcia she didn't want Ryan around, and she never really disclosed what the falling out was in regards to, but Marcia didn't pry. Now, Ryan being there after all this time was strange, but was it sinister? Marcia said that also at one point during the night, she heard Mike and Ryan talking about what she thought was a conversation about a gun. She said she heard something along the lines of, "This is where I keep it." So she was basically just making an inference about what they were talking about. Ryan said, yeah, you know, he told investigators, "I knew Mike had guns in the home," which were now missing, but they weren't talking about guns that night. And the falling out, it really wasn't between him and Mike at all. He'd had a fling with one of Terry's friends, and it ended badly. So Terry didn't want Ryan around. Again, this lead was a dead end because Ryan was at a funeral at the time of the murders. Well, Ryan may not have been their guy, but maybe the missing guns would turn up somewhere else, perhaps be used in another crime, and they'd be able to track the killer that way. Maybe, or maybe something even better would happen. They got a call from Terry's sister, Lori, saying, "You know, since the murders, I've been calling Terry's phone because I just really want to hear her voice. I miss her, and I want to hear her voice, but today, the phone started ringing."
Oh.
And they're like, "Whoa, you know what this means, Lena? Who cares about tracing the guns? They've got a cell phone."
Okay.
So they start pinging
this
phone.
Where's this
and
cell phone?
They tracked it into Lansing, which, like I said at the beginning of the episode, was just 15 minutes away. Well, Lansing is the capital city in Michigan, which I didn't actually know because I wasn't paying attention, you know, in school when you memorize the song with all the capitals in it. But my point is that Lansing being the capital city of Michigan means a lot of area needs to be covered. And it wasn't exactly going to be easy. Another thing is that whoever had the cell phone kept turning it on and off.
Ah, geez.
So they're driving around Lansing chasing these pings, but without the phone being on and producing some sort of pattern, they're just burning gas at this point.
How frustrating.
But remember what else was missing from the home? Specifically, what was missing from Terry's purse?
Her wallet.
Her wallet. See, Lena, that's why I keep you around.
Yeah.
Her wallet. So maybe this idiot who's in possession of her phone and keeps turning it on and off, maybe he's using her bank cards too. And Jimmy Crackcorn, Terry's bank cards had been used at a gas station very shortly after the murders. We're not dealing with the sharpest tool in the shed, because what's at gas stations?
CCTV.
CCTV footage, Lena. They spot this bright red Trans Am or Firebird. They couldn't really tell at that time. At the gas station and the ATM. And it was there that they got a glimpse of the man using the card. Now, he had this tissue or some kind of napkin or something raised up to conceal his face. So they couldn't get any identifying features, but it was a white male, and he had on a blue t-shirt with some kind of writing on it, which, to me, I think if they would have put that on the news, that would have been an identifying feature, because it was kind of like one of those baseball shirts. So as the officers are driving around, burning gas, chasing these pings, now they can be looking for this not-so-inconspicuous car. I mean, it's not like they were looking for a white Toyota Corolla. They're looking for a bright red sports car. And it didn't take them long to find it either. The car. They pulled him over and arrested a Christopher Perrin. Who?
Yeah, who?
Now, we're going to get to that in just a minute, and you're going to be furious. When he was arrested, Christopher was calm. He didn't react much to the arrest, but he wasn't talking. He denied any involvement in the crime. So let's talk about his trial. Judge Edward Grant proceeded over the trial, which began April 15th, 2013. Okay. Chief Assistant Prosecutor Doug Lloyd laid out the events of September 22nd, 2011 for the six-man, six-woman jury. He told them how Christopher had been scoping out places to rob in the area. And on that day, he walked right up to the Greens' Delta Township home and walked right through the front door, which was unlocked. They believed Mike was down in the basement on the computer when he heard someone come in. Maybe he thought it was Terry, so he came up the stairs to see who it was. And that's when he saw a random man standing in his home at the top of the stairs. And that's when the tussle began. So, they believe Christopher fired off some shots and missed, which explains all the shots around the home. And then he finally hit his target. Then, Terry arrived home, and she saw him, like, through the door. She didn't even make entry into the door. She saw this man in her home, and she took off running to the barn. And that's where she was shot and killed. So, initially, investigators thought maybe she was killed by the pond, but once they reviewed all the evidence, they believed that Christopher actually shot and killed her in the barn and loaded her body into a wheelbarrow and took her all the way down to the pond where he dumped her in the water. He then went back into the house, defiled Mike to stage this horrific scene,
stole
his guns, Terry's wallet, their cell phones, and some of Terry's jewelry. Now, I'm not sure why, but Christopher was not charged with possession of stolen property, even though he had Mike's guns in his storage unit, in a storage unit that was registered to him. Of course, the defense said, there's no direct evidence linking my client to the scene of this crime. The jury didn't want to hear that, though, and they returned a verdict of guilty on two counts of felony murder. And May 5th, he was sentenced to two life terms without the possibility of parole.
Wow.
Yay, yay, yay. He was also found guilty of weapons charges and home invasion. I say inconsequential. I mean, far more damage was done, but I appreciate the extra paperwork and, like, charging him with the extra stuff. Thank you for that. Earlier, I told you that you'd learn something in this episode that would infuriate you. And we've come to that part of the episode. Elena. At the time of Mike and Terry's murders, Christopher Perrin was incarcerated, but he was actually out on a work release program.
Oh my gosh.
He was serving a 300-day sentence for stealing credit cards, and a judge approved him for a work release program, which, get this, meant he was eligible for release between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday through Saturday. I'm sorry. What's the incarceration then?
Yeah, what is the point? Like, we'll give you a place to sleep. Legitimate
question, Judge. Remember when we covered Sherelle Dell, like her case, and she wanted to get out on that work release program? Well, Christopher said he worked for Advanced Building Contractors. That was the name of the company. He provided them a phone number, even a letter of employment, so he'd be able to get out of prison on this work release program. Well, no such company existed.
Oh my Lord.
Yep. Terry's family filed a federal lawsuit against the Eaton County Sheriff's Office, the Michigan Department of Corrections, and named some officers within both of those agencies because Christopher shouldn't have been eligible for that work release program in the first place.
Absolutely.
He was a repeat offender, and the job didn't even exist. Yeah,
who checks up on these things? Somebody clearly did not do their job. Someone
didn't do their job, exactly. And the 300-day sentence was as a result of his fourth offense.
Wow.
Fourth.
I can't.
So he had been in violation of his parole when he stole that last set of credit cards, and he'd been in a work release program before.
No, ma'am.
And failed to report to those jobs and appointments with his probation officer. So all this taken together, you'd expect that he'd have endured a harsher sentence than 300 days in prison and a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Let's just see if it'll happen again.
The guy should have never been allowed out. Full stop. Yet, somehow he was allowed to go to this fake job. And like you said, a simple phone call to this supposed job would have shown that no such job existed. But that phone call wasn't made. Someone didn't do their job.
Right.
Someone didn't pick up the phone to verify. Exactly.
Lovely.
Ugh, well, we're not done being mad here. Because U.S. District Judge Janet Neff dismissed the lawsuit saying, quote, "The plaintiff's allegations, nonetheless, do not support the proposition that they are affirmative acts that created or increased the danger to the decedents," end quote.
What?
She further went on to say, in her 23-page dismissal, quote, "The county defendants similarly argue that there are no allegations or evidence that any of the defendants could possibly have known that the decedent would be targeted for robbery and murder by Perrin. The county defendants similarly assert that there is no evidence that Perrin even knew
his victims
before committing the crimes at issue," end quote. Essentially, she's saying, well, yeah, I mean, he was let out of prison by the Department of Corrections and the sheriff, you know. But they didn't drive him to the Greens' house.
They might as well have. They didn't
know he would go off and murder two people. That's basically what she's saying. I wonder if you'd be saying the same thing if someone was mistakenly released from prison and went and killed your family members, Janet.
Hmm.
It's infuriating. Right. Absolutely. So, I just want to tell you one last thing before we wrap up this sheesh show for the kids. Christopher Perrin was actually suspected in another double homicide. A couple named, get this, Michael and Kathy Green.
What?
I just told you this case about the murders of Michael and Terry Green, but this is another Michael Green and his wife, Kathy. This couple lived in Big Whitefish Lake, and they were murdered in their home October 28, 2010, just 1 year before Mike and Terry were murdered. Big Whitefish Lake is about an hour and a half away from Grand Ledge, Michigan, where Mike and Terry lived.
Okay.
Mike and Kathy Green were stabbed to death, their throats were slit, and their home was set on fire. Now, Christopher was never charged or convicted in that case, but he actually looked a bit like the composite sketch released to the public, and there were some similarities in the case.
Oh.
First, the method may have been different, you know, stabbing right. versus shooting, but the police said this was a crime of passion in both cases. Someone who would brutally stab two people, slit their throats, and then burn their home.
Oh, geez.
Well, look what happened to Mike Green.
Right.
I mean, with his pants pulled down and those papers shoved up into his rectum, you'd never initially think that a stranger would do something like that. That's why it's important to, you know, look at all angles. Also, both cases involved robbery. Credit cards and money were taken right. from Mike yeah. and Kathy. So robbery was involved in that crime, too. The Montcalm police, they've considered Christopher for the other Green murders, but they just don't have anything to place him there. You know, just like they didn't really have anything to place him at the murders of Mike and Terry either. The murder of Michael and Kathy Green, the murders of Michael and Kathleen Green, actually at the time of this recording, are still unsolved. So if you have any information about the murders of Michael and Kathleen Green, the Michigan Arson Prevention Committee is offering a $5,000 reward. You can contact the Montcalm County Sheriff's Office at 989-831-7590 or the tip line at 888-755-8477. My final thoughts for this episode are this. Law enforcement rely on patterns of behavior to profile criminals and to solve these brutal crimes. I think, you know, in science, we rely on data, patterns, and this kind of is a theme throughout the world. Mm-hmm. We acquire this knowledge based on our past experiences. So for these investigators, their experiences over the years, these patterns and the things that they learn become a huge asset to them while approaching these new cases, you know? But when you get these outliers, when a complete stranger would murder a couple yeah. and defile a human being like Mike was, that is the definition of pure evil.
Yeah.
And that is the scariest part. And this actually brings me to something that happened in your case last week, Lena. Aretha was stabbed, what, 38 times?
38 times.
And while her killer did know her, you know, we always say, oh, this is overkill, this is anger, this is intimate. Nobody would come up, you know, a stranger wouldn't come up to someone and stab them 38 times. Mm-hmm. And while that's true in Aretha's case, I've heard it said that sometimes a killer, like, will not kill the person the first stab, the second stab, the 15th stab, you know? And someone won't die they thought they would die, so they stab them until they die. So investigators learn these little nuances throughout their career,
yeah.
and they know we can't get sidetracked on this. We can't say this was passionate, so it has to have been something mm-hmm. somebody they knew. So let's get pigeonholed on all the people they know. And a good investigator would, you know, keep an open mind. But for a complete and utter stranger to pull down Mike's pants
sense to me.
And documents, paper documents, up his bum. I just can't find the words. I don't believe for a second that Mike and Terry Green were his only victims.
Like, how did he get here? Like, we talk about, you know, their childhood and what brought them to this. When you mention they're both of his, you know, the first case that he's suspected in, they're both Michael Greens. I mean, was he trying to, like, take their name for a new identity? But even at that, because he stole their cards and stuff. But
ooh, that's interesting. I didn't think of that.
I mean, that crossed my mind. But if it's just that, why go so far as to defile them like that? Oh, and to put Terry in a wheelbarrow and take her down to the pond. Like, why not just leave her where she is?
I thought the same thing. Like, why not just shoot her in the barn and leave her there? Why take the time to load her up and risk someone seeing you loading the body up and wheeling it down to the pond?
Right.
You would think that he would just take what he could get and get the heck out of there, but he spent all that time. And when Terry's parents called and he answered the phone and they're like, oh, we're looking for Terry, we can't get a hold of her.
Yeah.
He had to have known that they were probably going to come over and look for her. Like, they couldn't get a hold of her.
Mm-hmm. And he had
the gall to just hang around. To me, that shows a comfortability.
Yeah.
With that kind of criminal behavior. Like, the fact that he, you know, took her down to the pond and then went back to the home. And he knew the clock was ticking. He knew her parents were probably going to be on their way.
Yeah,
I just think it just shows a brazenness that he's done this before.
Yeah, sounds like it to me.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, we have this kind of echo from your case last week. Just the repeat offense, not being held accountable in the first place.
Yeah.
And look, lives were lost because someone couldn't be bothered to pick up the phone and make a phone call.
That's heartbreaking.
Right. No. 8-7. Come on now. That is so stupid.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of that? Our justice system sucks, sucks, suckety sucks.
I mean, there are good things about the justice system, but I'm so tired of hearing these. Okay, here's another chance. Here's another chance.
I know.
And some people need another chance and they can actually be a good person.
And they don't get it, though. Some people do not get that chance.
How do you choose?
I know. I have two people that I knew that, you know, they were good people and they got slapped with some serious, serious time and no second chances.
Wow.
So these cases really infuriate me because some of the most deviant criminals get second, third, fourth chances. It's garbage. But that's it. That's what I got for you.
All right. Well, now that I'm good and mad, I can go clean my house.
Isn't that the best way to take your frustration out?
Yeah. Well, thanks for telling this story. It was good. Let's do it again next week.
Let's do it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.